You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening and welcome. We're very grateful that you made it despite the impending doom of weather outside. We're delighted to have you along with our wonderful panel of speakers here tonight to discuss the global pain crisis and talking about narrowing the gap in access to palliative care. My name is Jenny. I'm a program officer in the public health program, and it's my privilege to be able to welcome everyone here and to engage our panelists in a conversation about driving change forward in this field. So OSF has been funding palliative care since 1998. which is a very long time. our efforts started in the U.S., but soon expanded to begin to address some of the global needs for palliative care. And this is a tension that we'll kind of come back to throughout the course of the evening, the access that people in high-income countries have to pain relief and palliative care compared to those in lower and middle-income countries. And those needs are great. Millions of people worldwide with life-limiting illness live and die in avoidable pain and distress. In fact, 75% of the world's population does not have adequate access to medicines for pain relief and suffer needlessly. Palliative care is not only an issue of social justice and fairness, it's also a human rights issue. Denying access to palliative care violates the right of everyone to the highest sustainable or to the highest attainable, state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, including access to medicines for pain relief. And that has been equated to torture in some human rights courses and in courts. So clearly this is an issue not only with respect to the right to health, but other human rights that are, of course, universal. So though the global disparity in access to pain relief is well documented, in fact, thanks to many of our panelists, neither the current unmet need for pain relief nor the fact that each of us may likely need these services in the future has been enough to stimulate broad public interest or sufficient political will amongst global health actors and implementers to tackle this problem. And as we'll get to later in the evening, in fact, this is a tale of two opioid crises in many ways. While policymakers in the U.S. are alarmed by the rising rate of overdose deaths, the majority of the world's population in need of pain relief cannot access medicines that have been available and cheaply produced for decades. The Lancet Commission on Palliative Care and Pain Relief will be publicly launching next month, and we're lucky to be joined here by two commissioners on that report. The report itself is a significant effort to document and draw attention to the global lack of access to pain relief, to demonstrate that palliative care is an essential component of universal health coverage, and to identify and cost a package of essential palliative care services that could be implemented given sufficient political will. So again, tonight we're honored to be joined by three fantastic speakers who can tell the tale of the other opiate crisis, the global pain crisis affecting most of the world, in highlighting the abyss in access to these essential services and the barriers faced in other countries. We'll explore the potential implications of U.S. policy on the overdose, policy reactions to the overdose epidemic for the rest of the world, and also describe some of the ways that advocacy groups have been chipping away at this issue. And so I'm going to briefly introduce our speakers. Each of our speakers will talk for roughly 10 minutes, and then I have a few questions that I will lead the discussion with, and afterwards we'll open it up to the audience for questions. Just for everyone to note, this event is being recorded so that we can share it more widely, and if you would like to ask a question when we reach that portion of this evening's event, put a hand up. Sarah Party, my wonderful colleague who is essential to pulling this event together, will walk around with a floating mic, and please be sure to speak into the microphone when you ask your question. All right, so I'm going to sit now. Great. So Dr. Rajagopal, who is in the middle of our panel here, is a palliative care physician from India, the founder and chairman of Pallium India, an NGO that created two palliative care centers in Kerala and established palliative care services for the first time across 8 states in India. He's also the director of the Trivandrum Institute of Palliative Sciences, and he serves on many task forces and boards to deliver palliative care globally. He is also, as many of you know, most recently a movie star. He features in the new documentary film by Moonshine Cinema, Hippocratic. There will be a screening of the film, the New York City premiere, tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. at the Regal Union Square Theater. So we encourage any of you who are still in New York and available to go to see the movie. It's nothing short of inspiring. Just to my left here, Donald McNeil Jr. is a science and health reporter at the New York Times. He specializes in covering plagues and epidemics. Joined the Times in 1976 and has held a number of positions there, working his way up from being a copy boy, as I understand, has reported on a range of issues, served as a foreign correspondent for 7 years, and has reported from 55 countries. He's an award-winning journalist who's written stories about HIV, patent monopolies that keep drug prices high in Africa, and also about cancer patients in India and Africa dying without pain relief. Many of you will be familiar with his fantastic article from this past December about opiophobia leaving the whole continent of Africa in agony without access to pain relief. In fact, on first interview, Dr. Rajagopal is part of a series of stories on pain relief in 2007. So we're very excited to have him here and to be able to get these two together again. And finally, at the end of the table, last but not least, Liliana De Lima is the executive director of the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care. She has worked in palliative care for more than 25 years. Before assuming her role in IHPC, the acronym for her organization, she worked previously with the Pan American Health Organization. She developed a regional framework in palliative care for countries in Latin America and was also the founder and coordinator of the Hospice La Viga in Cali, Colombia. And that was the first hospice in Latin America, so that was really wonderful. So as I mentioned already, Liliana and Dr. Rajagopal are commissioners with the Lancet Commission, and Liliana will touch a little bit on the commission's findings, and a brief summary of that report is also available just outside. Thank you all so much for joining us. We're excited and honored to have everyone here for this event, and without further ado, we'll get started with two clips from the new movie Hippocratic. Mark, thanks so much for cueing the second clip, and then immediately after that, we'll go to clip number 3, and then I will turn the microphone over to our speakers. Thank you, everyone.
I am very proud of my country, of its cultural heritage, of its atmosphere of love and bonding between human beings. I am proud of the sincerity and openness of our people. I am not so proud of the fact that we Indians allow 1/3 of our population to be below the international poverty line. The least I can do is not to worsen the situation. But the medical system is today feeding that poverty even in the relatively affluent state of Kerala in India. A study by a reputed organization, Center for Development Studies in Trivandrum, found that in rural Kerala, 1/3, almost 1/3 of all poverty was caused by disease and its treatment. We have to remember this, that even if we cannot solve it, we can at least try to avoid it. We can certainly try to avoid the infliction of needless treatment and needless investigations to patients. How can we justify a medical system which is today in India 80% in the private sector, which is not controlled by any national authority, which is free to do as it wants without any operational guidelines or standard operating procedures, without any monitoring system. In 1985, the government of India passed a draconian act, the Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances Act of India, which significantly reduced availability of morphine for people in pain. Already the situation was bad enough. It made it really bad. If we look at the morphine consumption in 1985, it was something in the order of 600 kilograms in the country. Mind you, all that was used mostly in operation theatres or emergency units for people with trauma and so on. Suppose this was 600 kilograms. And then came the NDPS Act, Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances Act of 1985. And the result was gradually pharmacies and hospitals stopped applying for morphine, stopped talking morphine, drug controllers stopped issuing licenses. So much so that by 1997, the consumption had dropped to about 37 kilograms. This kind of drop. Mind you, if everybody who needed morphine for pain relief got the morphine, India with its current population would need something like 36,000 kilograms. And this actually means this kind of increase in the burden of pain in the country.
Great, thank you. So we'll turn it over to Dr. Rajagopal.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Good evening, everybody. And thank you particularly for giving me the privilege of meeting Donald again after a gap of 11 years. And Liliana after a gap of about 11 days, I think. What I would try to do in the 10 minutes is to present the depth of the problem, explain where we are now, and also briefly go into the opportunities for the future. I think you'll have to give me the next slide. I don't think I can. I'm managing to do this. So, Donald, 11 years. Your landmark article in New York Times was something that gave significantly strengthened our hands, and so much of efforts by so many people. I saw the disappointment in your face when you talked about the current status. Unfortunately, though we are making progress, like the rest of the developing world, the progress is too slow. Our state of Kerala in South India is supposed to have the most access to morphine and to pain medicines. And in our hospital, that was just 3 years back, or almost 4 years back. Things have not improved. The parents of a 10-year-old boy killed their only son and then hanged themselves in the hospital room, leaving a note saying, "We are doing this because we cannot bear to see our son suffering anymore." I sometimes find it very difficult to think about that, those few minutes when the child must have been struggling and the man must have held on to that rope in which he stringed the child up. I think that child and that family and the millions of people in pain around the world should be on our collective conscience. We are allowing this to happen to 80% of the global population, the global south. Next, please. One doctor of Indian origin who works in New Zealand now wrote that sentence. In India, the poor die in misery in neglect, the middle class die in misery in ignorance, and the rich die in misery on ventilators. No one gets a pain-free and dignified death. That's not an overstatement. I sometimes think the poor are better off. They may still be in pain, but they'll be with their families. And when the throat is parched, there'll be somebody to drop a few drops of water down the throat. Whereas the rich in our country and in most of the developing world end up in corporate hospitals, in intensive care units, separate from the families. And when they want a few drops of water, what they will get is a suction catheter down the endotracheal tube, which is dreadful agony, and they die horrible deaths. Therefore, it is not surprising that the Economist Intelligence report classed India as one of the worst 15 among 80 countries to die in. They studied 80, and that's where India is. We certainly have no reason to be proud about that situation. Next, please. We have been working at it for, my colleagues and I have been working on it for more than a quarter of a century. In 2003, we formed Pallium India. And in 2006, we set up the Trivandrum Institute of Palliative Sciences. Its objective is mainly to attempt integration of palliative care with healthcare in our country. We are also a WHO collaborating center for training and policy on access to pain relief for Southeast Asian region. In Trivandrum, we provide palliative care directly and we run an education center. Education, palliative care education is in infancy even today. And we get doctors, nurses, and social workers from all over the country to undergo our courses. And when we send them back, we try to catalyze the development of palliative care centers in the various places. These champions usually do not get enough support from the administration or from the government. And therefore, they need a bit of hand-holding and a little push as they taxi till they take off and can be independent. But one of our major roles as we see it is advocacy. I'm very grateful for the international media and for the international organizations who give strength to our hands. We advocate with the government for policies. We advocate with the public for improved awareness so that they can demand for something that we have failed to make happen yet. The institution also concentrates on palliative care education and research and run an information center providing information about availability of palliative care as well as about the needs of patients and what can be done. Next slide, please. All the states that you see in color and the stars indicate places where we have set up projects. This is not an easy task. I'm so sorry to see that so many states are still in gray. Many of them practically have no access to palliative care at all. That is a sad state, but I'm glad that there are some positive developments. I do hope that finally we seem to be moving towards a steep part of the growth curve. Next slide, please. Some of the good things that happened recently was that the very draconian Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances Act has been simplified by the Indian Parliament. It took us 19 years to achieve this. It took us so much of support from the international media. But finally, it has happened. We also got the Government of India's Department of Health to form a national program for palliative care. And Medical Council of India, which is a statutory body which governs medical education, approved of palliative medicine as a specialty, started a postgraduate education program, and many years back agreed to include it in undergraduate education also. They agreed to do it, they have not done it. In each of these areas, unfortunately, we still have so much of work to do. Most of you would think that if a law has been passed, it will be automatically translated to implementation. That doesn't happen in many of our countries. It still needs a lot of work. The central government formulated the law. 29 individual states have to implement it. It's all complicated. It's much easier not to implement it. So we just have to go on hammering away at it. And Liliana, thank you for coming in and supporting this movement. There's a lot of work to be done. The National Program for Palliative Care means that from Delhi, from the central government, they give money to the state governments for palliative care. But the state governments do not know what to do with it. And very often, the money is spent in useless fashion so that it doesn't reach the man in pain. So there also, our catalytic action becomes very vital. And medical education still, today's medical student or nursing student, even today, does not know how to apply the World Health Organization's analgesic ladder. Next, please. So a lot of work there yet, but I'm very grateful. That couple is Mr. Mike Hill and Sue Hill. The couple created a series of films which have been very powerful tools in global palliative care advocacy. They produced Life Before Death. They produced Little Stars based on palliative care in children. And now they produce Hippocratic. I know that it was not easy for them to get funding for all this. I don't think any of the palliative care movies so far has made them millionaires. But they continue to do it. I'm very grateful to them. Thank you very much for listening to me patiently.
Donald, we'll turn to you now. Thank you.
Raj, I realized as you were talking that you were describing my father's death. And one thing that struck me about it, my father died in a hospital, a nice hospital in San Francisco, and would have died hooked up to a ventilator. But his biggest concern at the end, when they realized that he had adult respiratory distress syndrome and he wouldn't survive, was that he wanted the ventilator pulled out and he wanted a glass of orange juice before he died. And fortunately, we were all there in San Francisco, so we were able to be there in the hospital room and let him take out the ventilator and get him the orange juice. And he was given a lot of morphine to help him with what was going to be the choking that came on once the ventilator was taken away. So I hadn't thought about, until you just said that, how much actually just the thought of liquid going down his throat would have meant that much more to him than I hadn't thought about how important that was until just now. So I'm a journalist, so I talk about sort of what I do and why I do it rather than talking like an advocate, because I'm paid not to be an advocate. Although what I do sometimes ends up being useful to the advocates, if I describe the problem correctly. I don't actually remember what got me interested in the question of palliative care for the first time in 2007. I remember I read an article, I think it was one by David Juranson, who was then at the University of Wisconsin's Pain and Pain Policy Center, and it described the situation in the world, and I thought, this is grist for a series. Every reporter wants to get a good idea that's new, and he can write a series based on hoping pathetically for some prize at the end of it. So I did write a series about the lack of pain medication for the world. I started it off in Sierra Leone, a country where no one had anything. There was no opportunity for pain relief, no matter what. Even the army had just a small number of pills for coma. And of course, it had a huge problem with drugs during all the warfare there. People often didn't even know what the drugs were. They were just known as brown or gunpowder or things like that. But there was a real fear of importing the drugs. But I wrote about a woman dying of breast cancer, with the tumor actually coming out of her chest, and no pain relief available to her at all, stronger than Tramadol, which is the equivalent of a cough medicine here. And I went to India to write about the irony of a country that produced much of the world's morphine, and that it grew opium for sale, and that in the fields of Rajasthan, the poppies were growing, and there was a plant that chopped it up and wrapped it up in big the brown raw opium, which is sort of like somewhere between molasses and chocolate fudge, was being wrapped up and mailed off to St. Louis, Missouri, where it was being made into morphine, mostly to be used by Americans. And Indians had very little access to pain, as Raj showed. And where Raj worked, they had the best. And Kerala was the only state that had a real program, thanks to Raj. And then I did a series, the next part of it was in Japan, where lots and lots of people were dying of cancer. They had an extremely advanced healthcare system and no official opposition to painkillers, but nobody wanted to take them just because of a longstanding fear of painkillers and a sense that you don't show weakness even towards the end of life. You grip on and die in pain. People had various reasons for it. And then I wrote a couple of pieces, one about Doctors Without Borders changing their attitude about pain control. They had originally conducted something like 70,000 operations or 7,000 operations using only 10 vials of morphine, and they'd realized that they were not interested in pain control for their patients for many years, and they finally changed their policies and changed their education. And then I wrote one piece about Afghanistan and whether or not the crops there could be used for pain control. We were, the United States Army was fighting a war against the opium trade as well as against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And a great deal of effort was spent in destroying something that could have been useful as medicine around the world. I hoped the series did some good. Raj was very kind to write to me in, was it 2012 or so, and say that it had helped pass the India's palliative care policy. And last year I met Meg O'Brien of the American Cancer Society, who started a group called Treat the Pain to try to bring pain relief to Africa. And she said that she had started it partially because she had been to an HIV conference. She worked for the Clinton Health Access Initiative, and she had gone to an HIV conference and heard about how many HIV patients died in severe pain, especially if they had cryptococcal meningitis or some other opportunistic infections. And then she said she had read my series, and that had helped convince her to leave HIV care and go into palliative care. But I wrote that article last year by chance. I was actually going to Africa to meet with Meg O'Brien because she had created a deal under which cancer medicines would be available to Africa at 1% of their prices in the United States, a deal in which two drug companies, Pfizer of the United States and Cipla of India, were getting together and agreeing to supply 16 different chemotherapy drugs to Africa at absolutely rock bottom prices. And the story about palliative care in Uganda was essentially a story on the side. If my bosses are happy when I can get two stories out of a trip rather than one. I had originally hoped to go to Ethiopia to write about the cancer story, but Uganda proved to be easier to get in, partially because of a profile I'd written of the doctor who's now the head of the World Health Organization, he wasn't unhappy with it, but the Ethiopians were unhappy about parts of it, because it had also exposed that Ethiopia had covered up the fact that it had cholera for many years and was calling it acute watery diarrhea, this nearly upended its chances of being elected. As I was writing that article, the one about pain relief in Uganda, I had always wanted to go to Uganda and write about the operation there, the Hospice Africa, because it really was the first operation in Africa that was successfully bringing pain relief to any country in the poorest parts of Africa. There are some things going on in South Africa and the richer nations. Not that there are many rich nations, what Anne Merriman was doing in Hospice Uganda was really quite remarkable. And Meg O'Brien and the American Cancer Society had sort of stepped in and brought the operation more to on a more professional level, and it extended it, sort of stopped some of the infighting that was going on in the Ugandan government, and professionalized it so that it was able to distribute drugs to much more of the country. And it was just my luck that the Lancet report came out at virtually exactly the same time. I thought I was going to have to slog through all the same documents I had worked on in 2007 and then called each one of the doctors and said, what do you know about what's going on in 2017? And instead, boom, the Lancet comes up with this brand new report they've clearly been working on for years. And I was able to talk to Liliana and to other doctors involved in it and say, tell me about the situation now. But what has changed in the interim, and it's very sad, is that America has had its opioid epidemic and a large number of overdoses, and that has changed the mindset of the world entirely towards pain relief, because back when I was reporting this in 2007, it was more of a theoretical problem. There were many naysayers who said, if you start handing out narcotics to poor people, you're going to get an overdose epidemic. And if we start handing out more narcotics in the United States, you're going to get an overdose epidemic. And sadly, sure enough, yes, that happened. I mean, you've all seen how badly the narcotics were handed out. I think Meg O'Brien put it very well when she said, look, the problem of the overdose epidemic in the United States was not caused by the cancer wards in this country. It was caused by the dental practices and the orthopedics wards. You know, in poor countries, you don't hand out Percocet for a strained ankle or a pulled tooth. You hand it out at the very end of life when people, but it was handed out way too freely in the United States. Originally with good intentions, there was a lot, even when I first started writing about it, there was a lot of resistance to the idea, and the doctors who were sophisticated about pain relief and palliative care said that there was a giant need even in the United States, both for patients to understand and not be afraid to ask for the drugs and to describe their pain, and for doctors to be willing to prescribe it. And then unfortunately, the whole situation went crazy and mills developed where drugs were being pumped out in enormous numbers, and that I can see the effect that that's had on the world just from the reaction of my own editors when I talk about the story idea. When I originally proposed the series back in 2007, they said, gee, that's a good idea, because I had no idea that the problem existed. Sure, go ahead and write about it. This time when I said I'd like to write about the need for the successful use of pain control in Uganda without developing a gigantic opioid overdose problem, the reaction was, oh, neat. What a counterintuitive idea. Who'd have thought it'd be possible to hand out pain relief without creating an overdose problem? And I'm afraid that's the mindset that is now controlling the debate, that opioids are a dirty word and people are afraid to prescribe them, and people are afraid that people in other countries are afraid that if they allow pain relief to happen, that the same thing will happen in their countries. You know, they will follow. If the United States can't get its act together and can have an overdose epidemic that it seems to be unable to control, how is it that our poor country will be able to control it? And I don't know how palliative care specialists overcome that, but it is a giant obstacle looming for the future. And with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you. And that is a topic we will certainly circle back to. Liliana, I am so keen to hear your perspective on this. We're going to show a very brief clip to explain a little bit about what the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care does. And then Liliana will talk a little bit about the Lancet and trying to stimulate some change in this area.
I think the work of IHPC is so important because nobody else does it. So you need somebody who's really concerned that everybody gets access to good care.
The gap has widened, and the ones in the high-income countries are the ones that are getting the best access to care.
So there's an enormous inequality, an enormous disparity in access to palliative care and pain control between rich and poor countries.
We have done great strides and wonderful improvements in high-income countries, but we have failed to bring those resources and enabling the individuals working in the low and middle-income countries to the same degree.
Palliative care and pain control are not readily available in the developing world. And the mission of IHPC is to change that.
So in children's palliative care, we know that there's about 21.6 million children globally who need palliative care, and yet people don't know about the problem.
It's focused on relieving suffering, and that's the underlying theme.
Practitioners and providers need controlled medicines in order to do palliative care, such as morphine, and they're unavailable in more than 75% of the world.
It is frustrating and heartbreaking to see patients suffering because of the unavailability of a simple cheap drug like morphine.
And I wonder if Jose wasn't feeling that sense of inferiority because he is not curable. And I wonder if the system is set up in ways to make this happen. Now, another quote from Dr. Martin Luther King says, "We have a moral obligation to disobey unjust laws." And I wonder if we don't have a moral obligation to challenge unjust systems, stand up to these systems.
I think IHPC has been extraordinarily inventive over many years to try to find any way to change things.
We go along with these big regional congresses and support the regional associations by bringing in people who otherwise couldn't come because they don't have the funds.
I think the best way to improve palliative care in the world and mainly in developing countries is through education.
For us, it's very important to have more knowledges and communication with others. Strengthen us.
I have been able to disseminate the knowledge, disseminate information regarding IHPC to other colleagues.
I know so many people who would have loved to come but couldn't come because they didn't have the means to make it here. So I'd like to say thank you so much and pray that that continues going on and on.
So, that was just a short film that we did. We did a series of films in one of the regional congresses. This was the World Palliative Care Congress, which is actually run by the European Association for Palliative Care. But it has become quite large, and they have participants from all over the world. So now it's called the World Congress. One of the things that we do is we bring participants from low-income countries who otherwise can't afford to go. They have to have posters and they have to have something to present during the conference, some kind of work that they've done. And more and more, it's also about advocacy and how they're helping to change things and matters and policy in their own countries. So we're hoping to teach them and coach the members of IHPC as well, that they are not just the clinicians caring for patients, but also wonderful advocates such as Raj. I mean, he's a shining star in the world. I think it's very difficult to follow his path, but people can look up to Raj and think that is a physician who also turned as an advocate and changed the legislation, and we can do that. So under that frame of mind, we are working very hard to enabling the people who are working, not just with the patients, but also with the governments and the policymakers. The quote from Martin Luther King that I mentioned, actually there's another slide before that I had, and these were the letters that he wrote from the Alabama prison. I don't know if you know, if you're familiar with those, but there is a statement that he says that the statutory laws that discriminatory statutes give a false sense of superiority to the discriminator and a false sense of inferiority to the person who's discriminated against. And I thought, this is the same that happens to patients who are incurable, because the system is set up so that patients can't access care unless they're curable. If you are in a developing country and you go to see the doctor in one of the big hospitals that Raj mentioned, he or she, the patient, may be told, we're sorry, we don't have anything else to offer, if it's a poor hospital. If it's a hospital that has resources and the patient has resources, they may end up in a ventilator, such as Donald's father or the patients that Raj described. So I think a lot of the patients, and I was thinking when I did that presentation about a case of a patient we had in Colombia when I used to run the hospice there, and it was a patient that we received who had developed cancer, he had a tracheostomy, and he never learned how to use it, so he couldn't talk, and he was illiterate, so he didn't write. And when he was brought in into the hospice, he was very unkept. He was dirty. He had not eaten for several days. He was actually living in a barn with some chickens and animals in the farm, because he was smelling so bad that nobody could resist him. And he had asked a friend if he could stay there. So his friend brought him over, and we cleaned him and gave him, you know, medication. It was a weak opioid, what we gave him, codeine at that time. And the next day, and we offered porridge, you know, something soft that he could swallow. And the next day, you know, we saw him. He was a lot better. He slept on a bed. He had taken a bath and clean clothes. And we had dinner or had something to eat. And we kept asking, you know, we saw that he was walking sort of in an awkward position. And we asked, Jose, what's wrong? And he said, you know, he just said, no, nothing is wrong. And he kept kissing our hands. His friend came over to visit the day after. And we realized there was something wrong with Jose, but we didn't know what was going on. And we said, go and find out. And we think that he's still in pain. Well, he came back and he said, yes, Jose is still in pain, but he's afraid of complaining because he has been expelled from every other hospital, that he doesn't want to be expelled of this place again. He doesn't want you to think that he's ungrateful. So that's the extent of the suffering that we have to deal with, and the extent of not just that patient, but the healthcare system, the way that it's set up. And this is the purpose of the Lancet Commission, actually, is to change the mindset of the healthcare systems in the world, so that care is provided since the moment you're born until the moment you die. Every single instance of your life that you need healthcare, the system should be there, available and timely to provide what you need in order to have good quality of life. Either could it be curative or preventive, rehabilitation or palliative care. I don't think we need to go into the slides because I don't think it merits, but basically the slides will show, you know, some data that you can get on the paper outside, and I think it will be much nicer to have the discussion going on, that to go over numbers. But what the Lancet report right now, and Raj is one of the commissioners, and we are working, IHPC is one of the organizations that will be in charge of the implementation resulting from the recommendations resulting from the report. So we'll have a launching next April, in 5 and 6 in Miami. And then after that, we'll start with the implementation and probably we'll select 5 to 6 pilot countries. And there's an essential package of interventions, medications, and a few things that we think are capable of alleviating that suffering that we've been talking about in 80% of the cases. And that package has been costed. It's not something that will significantly affect, the GDP of any country. We've done the analysis, and we think it's doable. So that's it. Thank
you. Great. Thank you all so much. And we're happy to make the slide deck that Liliana was referencing available to anyone who's interested. So please just reach out to us for that. So I want to start by asking Liliana and Dr. Rajagopal, why aren't we closer to narrowing the gap? What, in your view, and then Donald, we'll turn to you as well, from your perspective covering health issues for so long, why haven't we been able to provide greater palliative care? We saw in the IHPC video that there's a rising group of people who are being educated. Clearly, Dr. Rajagopal is working tirelessly to bring education and broader access in India. If you had to pinpoint the problem, what is it? And so we'll start with Liliana and then Dr. Rajagopal.
I think it's the way the healthcare systems are set up. And we need to change that, the mindset of, and that also affects how physicians and healthcare professionals are educated, how healthcare systems are funded, and how healthcare systems settings are developed and constructed and built upon. If we can change that mindset that you should receive the care you need regardless of the prognosis, that to me is the greatest challenge.
So, in addition to what you said, Liliana, possibly the advocacy efforts have been mostly by a few professionals and not exactly from the people who suffer. I think their voices, if we could bring them out, really should be much more powerful. We are advocating something that's not very convenient for the existing system to follow. It's so much easier to go on doing whatever they have been doing that brings in more money for the healthcare industry, and the doctors feel safe. They don't have to see the suffering. You can turn away, concentrate only on the diseases. So we are advocating for something that's inconvenient for the system. And we are unable to force them to do it so far. So that effort, I believe, will have to come from patients' families because patients themselves are suffering and cannot raise their voice. So maybe I strongly believe that our advocacy efforts should focus on that. Secondly, if it was, say, something as simple as polio eradication, the procedure is simple, easily understood. In palliative care, we cannot just give a protocol to every doctor and do palliative care. It means a change in the mindset. More of education is needed. And there again, I still believe that there has been no specific strategy for developing countries and relieving suffering. We have global strategies. Eventually, that ends up affecting changes only in the global north. The problems are different, of course, from country to country, but there are some common problems. And everybody would say it is money, but it is not a question of money. So maybe we also need a global strategy specifically addressed to the global south.
Interesting. Yes, so I'm going to turn to you, Donald, now. Given the amount of time you spent kind of covering the space, Is this kind of what you're seeing too? What's your take on why this problem persists the way it does?
I think part of the problem is I cover a lot of diseases, and maybe 50. And some diseases are hip, and you know, like polio, and flu, and Ebola, and plague, because they have sort of hooks that stick in people's minds. And sometimes they have famous victims, or they have powerful spokespeople. Palliative care and the end of life do not have famous spokespeople, because unfortunately nobody survives it. And the people who need the care most are often unable to talk, and very often about to die. So we all know famous people who died of AIDS, Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Glazer, Kimberly Bergalis, and others in the and hundreds of people in the arts and theater in the early days of the epidemic spoke up loudly and eloquently for the disease, often as they were dying. And some diseases have champions. Polio had Franklin Roosevelt. Yellow fever had Walter Reed. You can sort of pick a disease, and there's somebody whose name is famously associated with it. You are the champion, but you're not a movie star yet. And hopefully that day will come, but you sort of, in some ways, you need other well-known spokespeople. Some diseases have, like malaria, get champions who speak up for them. And I think that makes a big difference, that people associate ideas in their minds. And I have a story to tell that's probably unfortunate. After I wrote that series, I got called by a representative of a powerful, rich guy who was a former Secretary of State, who was looking for a cause, and called me and asked about, what would you think of my taking this up, and what would it mean, and what would be getting involved. And I mean, I'm not saying who the name is, because he asked not to be talked about, but I said, I think it'd be extremely useful. I think it's not just a question of money, but I think it's a question of advocacy. And I sort of described people that he might get in touch with. And he said in the end, he said, what do you think about it? And I said, look, it's not for me to tell you what to do. And I always try to make a point of being a journalist and staying back from advocacy that way. But I said, you are going to have to get used to the idea of being basically the world's biggest narcotics dealer. And there was a long pause on the line, and he said, I'll think about it. And I hope I didn't discourage him from becoming the champion for the disease at that time, but the disease definitely needs a champion. The situation needs a champion. There needs to be a sort of, it helps if the advocate is rich, or popular. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please go ahead. And then I'm going to turn to the final clip that we wanted to show from the Hippocratic movie. Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking as well that there's a lot of commercial interests in keeping treatments going on. And a lot of that happens in the decisions that are taken when futile things are implemented or approved or done to a patient. Just because they keep the money kind of rolling in. So just wanted to.
That was the perfect segue to the next clip we'll show. And then I'll turn it back to the panel.
Unfortunately, one very, very real development, especially in the last 35 or 40 years, that's the transformation of health service to healthcare industry. In steel and in concrete, we have built bigger and bigger hospitals, fortresses with armed guards keeping patients out. Modern, brave new world has evolved it into a truly successful industry. Now, growth of healthcare as an industry has certainly improved our ability to conquer more and more diseases. But somewhere, medical practice lost a bit of the heart. It's all brain now. What has happened is the process of diagnosis, the technology that is evolved in UK, USA or Australia, in my country, and in 80% of the globe, that's the developing world. Even the process of diagnosis, the imaging, the MRI scans and everything will financially destroy many families. That's the reality. And then comes the treatment. What the industry wants is not only cure of the disease, it's also profit.
I see a lot of nodding heads. And this is certainly something that we try to tackle head on in the public health program, but thinking about the way the healthcare industry has become over commercialized. And I wonder if each of you could speak to the impact of the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry on access to controlled medicines for pain relief. Liliana, I know you've done work around opiate pricing. Raj, perhaps you can add a little bit more about specifically the role of the pharmaceutical industry. And Donald, that will be the same question for you. Thanks.
So we started about 4 years ago a project called Opioid Price Watch. I don't know if you are familiar with a report that is put out by the Health Action International. It's an NGO based in the Netherlands, and they always put together reports every 2 years in collaboration with WHO about the prices of essential medicines. Now, they've never included opioids. And when we asked them, why are you not including opioids? They said, well, opioids are a controlled substance. They have two, you know, different things that affect the pricing, and we don't know anything about it, blah, 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 blah. So we decided to do it ourselves. And we started working with WHO. Sorry, that was in 2011. We're getting older. So we've done three cycles, and what we do is we have now, it's a project to monitor the dispensing price, so actually the price that the patient has to pay at the pharmacy level for the opioids. And we looked at all the different prices of opioids, and it was striking what we found out, and we've done three cycles already, and the third cycle has proven exactly the same conclusion of the first one, and is that somehow, when you look at the, let me see if I can, explain this, but there's an international market. So let's say a pharmaceutical company buys the raw product from a vendor in Australia, and then they manufacture the medication, and then they may be wholesalers and sell it to a pharmaceutical company in the USA or any other place, or India or Colombia or Burkina Faso. And when we looked at the dispensing price, somehow those medications that were higher in the international market as compared to morphine, when they come down at the dispensing level, they were cheaper. How did that happen? So why are they government, why are they subsidizing the more expensive formulations of medications and not the cheap morphine? And at the end, what happens is that morphine is not available. What is available is the expensive fentanyl patches, the sustained release formulations, and all the other things that are more profitable. We also looked at what is included in the essential medicines lists in the national countries, in the national medicines list. And we found out that certainly morphine, they put it in there because it's in the WHO model list, but all the other expensive formulations are also added. So automatically they get funded by the government. Somebody's getting favors. And the way we looked at how that pricing affects the patient is we looked at something which is called affordability, and it's how much it would cost in terms of days worked somebody who has the lowest wage in the country. And Bangladesh, somebody has to work 77 days to pay for 30 days of treatment. In Mexico, they have to pay 190 days to pay for 30 days of treatment. In Honduras, 302 days to pay for morphine. One ampoule of morphine in Honduras costs $10. When in the international market, it's 3 cents of a dollar. Fentanyl patches, they're cheaper. So physicians get to prescribe these expensive formulations. They're taking over to conferences and meetings, and it's only those who can afford get access to treatment. So in a nutshell, that's a little bit of the findings that we...
Thank you. And Dr. Rajagopal, where have you seen the impact of the pharmaceutical industry on access to controlled medicines in India?
Let me start with the positive. The industry, an element of the industry, Dr. Hamid of Cipla, whom you mentioned, who made HIV medicines available at low cost to Africa, who changed the world. I mean, what would the world have been like today if that was not done? He also made low-cost morphine available in our country. I have in my state a commercial entity producing and selling at minimal profit 10 milligrams of morphine costing less than 2 cents of your money. So this is possible, but do we have a strategy for controlling the other elements? Oh my God, I don't know. I mean, this is a giant that is, we can't even see its face. It's towering somewhere there. And I have no clue how we are going to limit their power. But purely by making or continuing to support, get the support of those elements of the industry who have a philanthropic interest, and ensuring low-cost morphine as widely as possible is something that I can think about. That's all.
And Donald, I'm curious, especially as you talked to the U.S. overdose epidemic, there have been more and more reports highlighting the role of the pharmaceutical industry in driving that epidemic, perhaps by marketing their products in a less than truthful manner. And I wonder, from your perspective, what role has the pharmaceutical industry played in driving both the lack of access in the developing world, but also in the ongoing crisis we have here in the U.S.?
What I know about this is not from my reporting, but from reading the work of other reporters, because I didn't cover the epidemic in the United States. But it's very clear that companies like Purdue Pharma had a great deal to do with creating the overdose epidemic in the United States, in that they knew perfectly well that hundreds of thousands or millions of pills were being shipped to pharmacies in small towns where they couldn't possibly have used more than 5,000 pills a year. And you know, it was clear that they were manufacturing and selling much more than is needed. I think the report concluded that there's 31 times as much total opiate consumed in the United States as the actual need we have. So the size of the illegal market is enormous. Whether or not they've conspired to do anything in poor and middle-income countries, I don't think so. I think they just don't care about poor and middle-income countries. And I think one of the things that a champion, should champions emerge, should be doing is making it clear that, look, all of these drugs are off patent. All of them are cheap. I mean, morphine is dirt cheap. Heroin, invented by Bayer back over a century ago, is dirt cheap. Methadone is dirt cheap. Codeine is dirt cheap. All these things can be made for pennies. The problem is controlling it once you get it close to the user. And the Ugandans have come up with something that they hope is successful, and that they import the raw morphine powder. It happens they import it from Scotland because they can get it cheaper there. They can also get it from Hungary, a couple of other places that make it, and they make it in a drum that sells for not too much money. And the drum has to go through all the customs clearances, as you can imagine. But then they mix it into pint bottles of water. Driving pint bottles of water around the country is a pain, but Coca-Cola does it, and larger bottles, successfully without having to sell people an injectable form of Coca-Cola, and without anybody turning it back into an injectable form of Coca-Cola. So it's reasonable to think that if you wanted to imitate the Ugandan model, and basically it's made at strengths low enough to do some good, not as much good as you could do with a more concentrated form, but low enough to do some good, but dilute enough so that you make turning it into a readily abused injectable form very difficult. And drinking enough morphine when it's diluted is hard and bitter and nauseating and puts you to sleep.
And I just want to ask one more question, then I'm going to open it up to the audience. I'm sure many of us have additional questions for the panelists. Liliana, could you please comment in your role in the global organization, what have been some of the impacts that you're hearing from your members and from the national places where you focus your work on some of the impact that you've seen already from what's happening in the U.S.?
That's a very good question, Jenny. I think what we've seen, and we've been doing workshops in Latin America and more recently in India on access to opioids and rational use of opioids, and we've seen now the fear and the reaction of the prescribers and the drug regulators on, oh, we can't let this become the U.S. problem. You know, we can't. But when we looked at the data, that was one of the other things that we looked at in the Lancet report. Most of the problem it's the U.S. There's a little bit of issues in Canada. There's a little bit of abuse in Australia and the U.K. Nothing in Germany, nothing in Switzerland, nothing in Austria. Nothing in France, which have very high consumption of illicit opioids. So it's not the opioids themselves, but it's actually maybe more marketing strategy and something that led to other things. Now, just to clarify that now the issue in the U.S. is not the illicit opioids that are producing the deaths, it's the illicit fentanyl, which is also carfentanil, which is high, very potent. And then also the heroin laced with that illicit fentanyl. So it's not even the illicit opioids, or if it's illicit opioids, are opioids that were not prescribed, but actually taken from somebody's cabinet or something else and were used for a different purpose.
Thank you so much. Okay, I want to open it up to anyone in the room. Sarah will be helping me walk around with microphones. And just for everyone's knowledge, when you get the microphone, just push the button until the light turns green, and then that will be on. So please.
Thank you very much for such an informative. Thank you. Sorry about that. A very, very interesting presentation, and I think you, all of you, addressed at some point or another some of the possible solutions for this. And I think this has to be contextualized within a developing world where basic healthcare is questionable at best. Certainly in the areas where I've worked, that's what I've encountered. But this sounds a lot like the mid-90s in terms of the United States and the AIDS epidemic and the HIV epidemic here. The best thing that I think you could do, and I would submit to you what you alluded to, is the people who are suffering have to be heard. They have to be there. They have to be at the table. You can't ignore them. It's not going to happen. And that also reflects on the comment about physicians in general, because physicians are taught to fight disease, certainly in the developing world, and never give up. And we all know the sequela of that. And I think that this is just the beginning of a, you know, very long uphill thing, as you all alluded to. But attitudes will change, you know. And again, I can't emphasize enough the importance of bringing the people involved at the table. We're all going to die. You know, it's not like, you know, we're all going to die. Get over it. And you know, thank you again. Very, very informative.
Thank you so much for that comment. Any other questions? Yeah.
Thanks. Yes, I agree. It was a very informative presentation. But I do have a question about the health care system, as you described, that it's sort of a free-for-all or that there's little guidance. Could you give a little bit more clarity about how the healthcare system operates in the area that you were talking about? I think that would be helpful and enlightening.
And are you asking specifically about India?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. Let me take one more question if there's another question before we go to the answer. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Raj, what is your thoughts about the availability of education of palliative care in the medical schools and postgraduate courses where people are already struggling, leading to a brain drain?
Great. So two questions for you, Dr. Rajagopal.
In response to the first question, it is really not only India. In most of the global south, treatment costs are out of pocket. So in my country, for 80% of people, they have to find the money themselves. It's only 20% out of which many are funded by the government because they are government servants, or a small minority who have an insurance system. All the other 80%, they have to find the money. That is the usual system. So the healthcare system, theoretically, the government has a system at tertiary, secondary, and primary level. But in my country, only like any civilized country would have 5% of their GDP spent on health, whereas in my country, it is still only about 1.25%. By 2022, it is plan to go up to 2.5%. Let's hope that happens. Even then, that's so little. So having a reasonably robust healthcare system, like we all learned from our grandmothers that without health, wealth is of no importance. So giving that importance to it is key for many of our countries. The palliative care education is the one thing. I mean, if a fairy came to me and asked me to make one wish, it is that introduction of palliative care into the undergraduate medical and nursing education that I would want. They have started a postgraduate course. So for our country with 1.25 billion people, we have 4 seats a year for a postgraduate course in palliative medicine. That's because the basic facilities need to be such, so many professors, so many beds, and so many facilities which are not available in the university hospitals. For many other problems, we can at least see a solution in sight. But here, I fear things are going to be delayed much. We are actually working with individual medical colleges and individual universities because the medical council is not responsive.
There are two questions, three. And we'll take this time, we'll stick with two questions and then have the panel respond. Thanks.
Dr. Rajagopal, first I heard your name and your work 10 years ago. It's amazing. Congratulations. And I can imagine the hardship that you came across and your group. It is hard to say that, you know, opioids are culprit or panacea for suffering, you know, or related, you know, issues. The treatment of suffering is not related only for cancer, for all other, you know, disease groups. And we forget to prevent disease in the world, right? As you said, disease is causing sick people, and that's the base of healthcare industry, That's how we became corporate. We are selling the education, medical education. We are selling drugs. We are selling, you know, the services. And it's especially worse in developing countries when they pay out of pocket. Then you will come across more blocks, you know, when it comes to palliative care, because then the goal is to sell the expensive treatments. So during this time, you know, in last 10 years, when you were working on advancing palliative care in India, did you come across with this, you know, corporate kind of healthcare system blocks that you had to sort of like fight against?
Great, thank you for your question. And did you, one more question before we turn it over to the panel.
Hi, my question is slightly different. I wanted to ask about the relationship between the global war on drugs and the lack of access to palliative care. I was wondering what role, if any, Dr. Rajgopal touched on this in his presentation when he spoke about how making drugs the law that made drugs illegal in India actually led to a massive drop in legal access to life-saving drugs. So if I wanted to ask, if, according to you, if there's any role for global drug policy reform advocates to help narrow the gap in access to palliative care, is it useful or is it harmful, especially given this context of this hysteria and fears created by the overdose crisis in the US? So just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Thank you. So Dr. Rajagopal, and then maybe Liliana, will you take that question?
Maybe I'm here and able to answer your question because I have not had the courage to take on the industry and fight it face to face. It is too huge a force. Very unfortunately, we have not worked out a system to convince the corporate sector that it is in their interest to start providing palliative care. It's happening more and more, especially people coming from the West, Indian Americans or Indian Britishers coming back for their treatment of their parents or aunt, demand pain relief. And that is slowly causing an impact. But then the fact remains, as Liliana said, that it is more profitable for them not to provide palliative care. So unless there is that public awareness and public demand, things will be hard to change. Attacking the industry is not easy because we do not have the strength to do that. Maybe the public awareness is the answer to prevention of exploitation by them. You want to try to answer the second question?
You're right. It's all related. And we're in this mess, actually, because of the convention. It is called the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but this was signed back in the 1961. And it came from as a result of the opium wars, and it was the first opium convention, and then that led to another several conventions, and that was joined in one single document, which is why it's called the Single Convention, because all it was formed by different conventions from Asia, Europe, Latin America. So they all joined together and did this single convention. Now, the single convention is a legal framework that all the United Nations member states, all the countries are legally abide, they have to abide to it. And we have obligations as countries to meet those, the statements. The conventions have a preamble. There's another convention that was adopted in 1971, which is called the Psychotropics Convention. And both the 1961, which is the narcotics, and the 71, which is the psychotropics, address the need and recognize the need to ensure access to these medications for the relief of suffering. And that's in the preamble. So it recognizes that this is a public health issue. But then it goes on and on and on about the restriction on the use, on the importation, on the certification, on the processing, licensing, blah, blah, blah. So how, you know, we have been working together with the international, you know, with the help of OSF and many other organizations that have a lot of the human rights background and legal background to raise the issue of this is a public health issue in Vienna, where the narcotic, the CND convention, the Committee on Narcotic Drugs meets, all the other meetings that are relevant to those, like the WHO in Geneva. And basically what we're trying to say is there's the issue of, yes, preventing abuse, diversion, non-medical use, but also what about the patients who need it for legitimate medical purposes. Now, the good thing, as Raj likes to say, is that UNGAS, which happened 2 years ago, now has a chapter related to access, which didn't have before. So now the countries, actually Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala joined together and wanted to delete, you know, get rid of the conventions and do a new one. But you need to do new conventions, you need 100% consensus. And there are several countries in Vienna that are very hardliners, and they, you know, they kill people who are drug users. We know cases. So they're not willing to do that. And the conventions will stay and will remain. But UNGAS was able to develop a framework and new recommendations that has now a chapter that recognizes the use, the medical use for people who have dependence problems, medical needs for opioids. So this is a very important issue, and I think a very positive step ahead.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, and it remains to be seen as to how that chapter on access can and will be actually used. So much of what we're talking about is moving from policy to implementation. Any other questions? Yep, there's one in the back, Sarah, and then a gentleman here in the middle.
Thank you. Yes, this comment and question comes, I'm a professor at John Jay College, and I'm also an ethnographer. And I'm beginning to do my research in Latin America with regards to drug addiction and pharmaceutical and historical memory. Liliana, what you said about mindsets and changing the mindsets, I'm so inspired by you acknowledging this, because in Latin America, at least, places like Chile, to change the mindsets, I mean, right now in Chile as a country, you know, as a case study, mental health and addiction is governed by the Ministry of Security. It's a security issue. It's not a mental health issue. How do you change this mindset of institutions, let alone civil society? That's another ballgame. What strategies would you suggest in the case of Latin America? Yeah, thank you.
We'll take one more question. I know. She threw you a softball.
So my name is Dustin.
Oh no.
Hello, okay, sorry. Dustin, I'm a geriatric palliative care fellow at Mount Sinai. So taking a step back, you know, and having no knowledge about developing countries and how the mindset is in care, is there more of a paternalistic care versus a care where, you know, we individualize patients' care and align with their values? And is that also a gap that maybe can be, you know, narrowed just aligning with patient values and family values? And is that some, like, do you see that in the teachings, for example, in India, where, you know, is it more paternalistic views?
So we'll start with Liliana and then turn to Dr. Rajagopal.
That's the million-dollar question, how to change mindsets. I think we always go back to the campaign, the HIV/AIDS campaign. That, to me, was a wonderful way to show how you can change mindsets, and changing something which was very discriminatory, very denigrating, to the empowering of the people who were living with HIV/AIDS, in making decisions, in accessing care, in demanding from the governments. When you cannot do anything unless you have a local partner. And the National Palliative Care Societies and the National Mental Health Societies, those are your strongest allies, and they should be, because they are the ones who can make demands from their government. As international organizations, we can't do that. We have to go through the diplomatic process. So the people who elect their governments, those are the ones who make demands. But we can coach them, we can teach them, we can give them the resources, we can show them how it's done. So you need to, I would say, my suggestion would be start to identify the local partners that could be the strength of your voice with the government. And then, you know, you stand behind them, you keep support, and you provide guidance. I think that also what has been mentioned, and Raj also was underscoring, is the importance of the voices. And you have a very strong voice, because these are not the palliative care people, who have very, very low voices, and they're end of life sometimes, so very weak. Mental health can have very strong voices, and I've seen them. So you could have very good, strong voices from the ground. Those would be my suggestions.
I'm going to take the moderator's privilege to also turn to Donald quickly and to also answer some of that question on strategies. And I wonder, in particular, what role can the media play in national level advocacy around palliative care, but also globally?
Okay, the first observation I might make about your question, you know, I get all my medical care at Mount Sinai, and I would not declare Mount Sinai a paternalism-free zone. So I wouldn't put all the onus on the developing world to worry about the paternalistic medical care there. I think the answer is that each country needs its own advocate, because every country has its own situation. Every country has its own attitude on the part of its doctors, attitude on the part of its patients, which really surprised me in Japan, because in Japan, there was this great reluctance on the part of people to take the drugs that were available to them. And I think each country has a very different situation as far as drug smuggling, drug abuse, the smuggling, the overdoses. Liliana explained the difference between, you know, same drugs in the United States and Canada and available in Western Europe, and some countries have big abuse problems and some don't. It's a bad idea to generalize about all these things, and the role of the media is going to have to be the role of the media in each country. I find it's good to take journalists by the hand and explain to them why something is a problem, if you can. I get 300 plus emails a day from people trying to do that to me. I read some of them. The role of the media in changing people's minds is very important, but you have to kind of find the right reporter and explain to them why opioids are not the end of the world and inevitably going to lead to overdoses in the street, and why there are people who they probably don't know about suffering who badly need those drugs. Going back to earlier, unfortunately, the people who need the relief are not able to speak for themselves often because they are at death's door. But people have to come up and speak for them and reach the media and also help to find a way to tell those stories. I think Hippocratic did a very good job of showing Raj visiting patients. And that's the way you make a story compelling. Get people involved. Don't just announce principles to somebody. And my experience with doctors is usually, doctors as a journalist is usually that when a doctor wants me to write about something,
I'll say, okay, I understand the principles, I understand, you know, what you're thinking about, but I need to speak to some of your patients. And almost always the first reaction is, oh my God, no, I'm not letting you jackals at the press near any of my patients. You know, I know the way you avoid people, you know, invade people's privacy. And besides, I have all, in the United States, we have all these HIPAA problems. And I'll inevitably say the same thing, which is, look, doc, do me a favor, ask them. And ask a bunch of them. Because my experience is that a certain number of patients will go, oh my God, keep those vultures of the press away from me. A certain number will say, all right, I don't necessarily want to be the poster child for this disease and have my suffering made public or my photograph out, but if my suffering will help other people from having to suffer similarly, okay, go ahead, you can speak to me, take my picture, talk about my life, show how I'm suffering. And there'll be a few who say, oh my God, the New York Times wants to talk to me? This is my 15 minutes in fame? Bring it on. You know, and you can't know until you ask them. And I find that whether I'm writing about flu in Pennsylvania or leprosy at Bellevue Hospital or HIV in Africa, it's the same sort of dichotomies. And also the attitude of the individual doctor is what makes the biggest difference in both the patient care and in the ability to translate that idea to a greater audience.
And Raj?
Let us learn from the past. Be people who advocate for access to pain relief. Maybe made the mistake of making your arguments too one-sided. We wanted all pain to be treated. We wanted the message that opioids were very safe. Maybe we needed the balanced approach. The Lancet Commission gave us the concept of serious health-related suffering as what should be our objective, not just life-threatening diseases. Suffering is our focus. The person who gets hooked to a medicine also is suffering. That also we accept. So, I mean, maybe we should hereafter advocate for safe treatment of pain. And wherever we are advocating for pain relief, we should also be advocating for putting in the safety net there. My second point is, our attention is always so concentrated on the hardliners. The hardliner pain therapist who wants opioids everywhere, and the hardliner who doesn't want opioids anywhere in the world. And this is, both are small minorities. There's the large chunk of people. Lilia and I were together in Geneva at a WHO meeting where this fund was happening. There was so much of fight. And the others were looking at this group and then looking at this group. And that's the majority. Maybe 70 or 80% of people who are not talking but listening and forming an opinion. We should be talking to them. But that change of the mindset is going to take time. And we will simply have to be patient and keep on trying.
Thanks so much. We are very nearly out of time. I wanted to thank our panelists so much for your time and energy. For sharing your insights and experience with us. Thank you so much to our IT support staff for helping the videos run smoothly. Biggest thanks to my colleague Sarah Pardee, who tackled all logistical issues and made tonight's event a success. Thank you so much. And last but not least, huge thanks to Alyssa Sadler, our fearless communications officer, for inviting all of you and for making this event happen. Please help yourself to food and drinks and enjoy for another 10 minutes in the lower lobby.